I would like to thank the organizers for putting together this conference and for inviting me to give a talk here. Let me put the first picture up here to explain what I'm going to be talking about.
Are you going to use the boards?
Yeah, I can turn this off. So in one variable, we have the Nash dilation theorem that everybody's probably very familiar with that says that if you have a contraction operator on a Hilbert space, then it has a co-isometric extension. That is, there is a larger Hilbert space and a operator acting on it for which the original Hilbert space is an invariant subspace. And this larger operator extends the beginning one, and it has the extra property that its adjoint is an isometry. So V is the co-isometric extension of T. And then this theorem is very nice because we actually have a lot of information about these co-isometric operators. We have the Wald decomposition theorem that tells us that every co-isometric operator is the adjoint of a unilateral shift of some multiplicity direct sum of the unit term. And so a few years ago when I started getting interested in multivariable operator theory, this is what I knew, and then you ask yourself, what do people do? And it turns out there's lots of different ways to generalize this, and at first that was very confusing to try to learn all these different things. And in fact, it's a big reason for having this conference is the success in generalizing this theorem to different settings. So there you can generalize this to the ball, to the polydisk. You can consider commutative, non-commutative cases. You can consider, when you're in the ball, you consider row contractions or column contractions. And so this one theorem, if you pair it with the extension theorem for the isometric operators to unitary operators, all of a sudden you have 10 theorems that you need to keep track of if you're in a multivariable situation. So a convenient framework for all of these theorems is a definition by Jim Agler, who were considered families of operators or families of tuples of operators in a paper that came out in 1989. So I will always take D to be my integer, that is the number of operators that I'll be considering. BD is the unit ball in the complex plane. And then Agler's definition of a family, it's a connection of D tuples on a Hilbert space. Each of the TIs act on the same Hilbert space, but of course different tuples may act on different Hilbert spaces here. And families have four main properties that define it. That namely, every family needs to be bounded. Each operator in each tuple in the family is bounded by a fixed constant, the norm. Restrictions to invariant subspaces preserve the family. So if you have a subspace of the Hilbert space that's invariant for every operator in the tuple, then when you restrict the tuple to that invariant subspace, you stay in the family. When you take direct sums, you stay in the family. And then this condition D, it's preserved under unital star representations of B of H, that just basically says that your family has some kind of a C star algebra definition. So if you have a unital star representation pi, and if you have a tuple in the family, then you conform pi of t, and that has to be in the family again. All right, so lots of things that you can think of form families. If you're in a situation where d is equal to 1, you can, of course, consider contractions when they're obviously non-bounded, when you restrict to invariant subspace or take direct sums, and contractions have this d star definition there. And similarly, isometries form families, subnormal contractions, hypernormal contractions, easy to check, all of these form families. Now I have to put contractions in there so that I keep the norm bound. For D bigger than 1, we can consider tuples of contractions. Of course, we may consider families of commuting contractions, or not necessarily commuting. We can, again, consider isometries, commuting isometries, or I could go to the ball and consider commuting spherical contractions, spherical isometries, row contractions, or you leave out the commuting part, all of these form families. So there's lots of examples of families. All right, so we're interested in extensions. If you take a tuple and you have another tuple acting on a larger space, you say that S is an extension of T, so if T is a tuple and S is a tuple, if you know what you think should be satisfied, namely that that H is invariant for each operator in the tuple, so I'll write just SH is contained in H for when I mean that SIH is contained in H for each I, and T is a restriction of S to H. So it's just an extension, so it's a 2x2 operator matrix for S, you have T in the upper left-hand corner. And then the crucial definition is the one of an extremal for a family. Those are the operators, or the tuples of operators, that can only be extended by taking direct sums, if you want to stay in the family. Of course, you can always extend it, but if you want to stay in the family, and remember, families have some kind of a norm bound, so there's going to be some kind of limit on how easily you can extend it and put a non-zero entry in this upper right-hand corner here. Okay, and I'll write T is an X of F for T is a extremal of the family F. And Agler's theorem is sort of a very abstract version of this Nash dilation theorem that says that whenever you have a family and you have a tuple in that family, then you can extend to an extremal of that family. Okay. So examples. And easy examples in one variable, of course. We take the contraction, the family of contractions. Then the extremals are the co-isometries. As you know, we know the theorem, Nash dilation theorem. So those should be the co-isometries. There's lots of ways to prove this, of course, and all of them are very easy. What I wanted to stress here is that you can actually, when you have an operator that's not an extremal, so you want to extend it somehow, you want to find to show it's not extremal, you want to find a non-trivial extension. So that's a extension that has something non-zero in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, so when you have a non-extremal in this situation, you can always extend it you can always find a non-trivial rank one extension. Okay, so you can find, you just take the Hilbert space H plus C and you tag on, one-dimensional operator, which would just be B there in the lower right-hand corner, and then the upper right-hand corner is of the time epsilon times x, where x is some vector, and by epsilon x I mean the vector that takes the constant 1 in the complex plane to epsilon x in the Hilbert space. And it's easy to figure out when such a 2x2 operator matrix is contractive. Obviously, if you take the epsilon smaller, that would decrease the norm. It's clear you need the B to be at least less than or equal to 1. If B is equal to 1, then it turns out you can't put anything up there in the for the epsilon x. You'd have to take 0. So it turns out that for you can make this contractive for sufficiently small epsilon whenever the x satisfies a condition that prevents it from sort of bumping into some part of the T where T is already very large. And that's measured by saying that x has to be in the range of the operator D star, which is a defect operator for the adjoint. So it's, you know, when you try to do a rank one extension, it's basically trivial to figure out what you need to do. And the fact is that non-extremal ones always have non-trivial rank one extension. And then the corollary using Agler's theorem is that you have the Nash dilation theorem. Similarly, for the isometries, the extremals there are the unitaries. And of course, we know isometries are of the type S plus U, where S is a unilateral shift. And again, unilateral shifts can be extended by rank one extensions. So again, in this situation, anything that's not extremal, so that has a unilateral shift summand, can be extended with a rank one extension. All right, then when we go to the multivariable situation, and I'll be only interested in this talk, basically only interested in commuting tuples of operators. I'll just be talking about the ball, perhaps the polydisk with Andrew's theorem and what happens for Anders theorem in dimension d bigger than 2 would be a more interesting topic, but I have nothing to say about that. So we'll be talking about commuting operators associated with the ball. And the first class, the first family of operator tuples is the spherical isometries. So those are the tuples that have the property that if you take summation of the norm of Tix squared, they add up to x squared for every x in the Hilbert space. And of course, it can also be described as saying that the summation of Ti star Ti is equal to the identity. So there's a C star definition of this family, and so it's easy to check this is a family. And then it turns out that the extremals of this family are what have been called the commuting spherical unitary operators. So these are not unitary operators per se, they are normal operators that commute with one another and whose spectral measure is supported in the unit sphere. And so they're spherical isometries that also happen to be normal. And the extension theorem is due to Atavale, and there is a proof of that theorem due to Atele and Lubin that you can use to show that these are the extremals. So in other words, what happens there is that let's say we have an operator tuple that is a spherical isometry but is not already a spherical unitary. Well, now you want to prove that it has a non-trivial extension. So in Atele and Lubin's proof, what you do first is you notice that every one of these operators, these spherical isometries, individually, they're subnormal operators. Okay, so there's a criterion that you need to check. So that works out. And then once you know that each one of them individually is a subnormal operator, you can take the minimal normal extension of, say, one of them, which may not be normal already, so we're assuming we start out with something that's not already normal. So one of them is not already normal. So you take the minimal normal extension of that, and it turns out all the other ones can be extended to the space with a minimal normal extension of that one operator lives, and you have a non-trivial extension. So that's how you can prove this theorem. And I mentioned the proof because there is a although the theorem looks very much like the one variable theorem that you have, that isometries can be extended to unitaries. In the proof, it actually differs because you cannot always extend these spherical isometries by rank one extensions. So I've called it a theorem here, but and we don't really need it if you already know the theorem that I had on the previous page. But I've written down when can you extend a spherical isometry by a rank one, by a non-trivial rank one extension. So, and I said, it's always pretty easy to figure out when can you do this, because rank one extensions are things where you can do calculations with rather simply. And so the condition that comes out has something to do with the Kozul complex for the operator. And I didn't really want to define what the Kozul complex is, and I only need the Kozul complex at the stage lambda one. So I have restated the condition that comes out just for that. And since it's easier to explain what it means to be exact at that stage, I had to do the contrapositive. So the theorem then reads that T has only trivial rank one extensions in the spherical isometries if and only if you take a point in the ball and you look at a sequence of vectors x1 through xd such that ti minus bi xj equals tj minus bj xi, then the xi's have to be of the type ti minus bi x. Okay, so why does that have anything to do with this? Well, remember we want to do rank one extensions, so our rank one extensions are basically going to look like ti epsilon xi bi, like we had in the case of one operator. And now, of course, we want to do commuting contractions. Okay, so or commuting spherical isometries. Well, the condition that I have here that comes up in this Kozul complex should remind you of you know what you need to check for two of these operators SI to commute. When two of these commute, you just check out what that means for the entry up here. Then you see that what would need to be satisfied is that Ti minus Bi xj equals Tj minus Bj xi. So if the Kozul complex for this is exact at that point, then there's a certain rigidity in there. So that means these, if that's satisfied, so if you have such a rank one extension, then the xi's had to be of a certain type. And it turns out then you can show with, you know, a little other stuff that that can't happen. So that's too much rigidity. So you, in those cases, if the Kozul complex is exact, then you do not have rank one extensions. Another thing I wanted to note here is that when you take an automorphism of the ball, then the property of being an extremal is preserved under taking an automorphism of the ball in CD. So if you have an extension, you apply an automorphism of the ball to the tuple. So now you get a new tuple. That's a spherical isometry again, you can check. And if the extension was trivial, then the phi lambda of T has a trivial extension. If it's non-trivial, you're going to have something non-trivial in the corner up there. So the condition that you get has to be invariant under ball automorphisms. So whenever you characterize this kind of thing for either rank one extensions or for extremals, you have to come up with a condition that's invariant under taking ball automorphisms. Oh, and then here I just have listed examples to show you that both things happen, that you can have spherical isometries that only have trivial rank one extensions, like the shift on the ordinary Hardy space, or you can take the ordinary unilateral shift and make it a tuple by just adding a bunch of zeros, then obviously that has a non-trivial rank one extension and it's a spherical isometry. So both things can happen here. So in the proof, the situation is different from the one variable situation. Okay, so the next class are the commuting spherical contractions that have been worked on by Drury, Müller-Vasilescu, and Arveson, and others, many others now. They're defined by just putting an inequality where I had inequality a moment ago for the spherical isometries. And the C star definition is that the summation Ti star Ti is less than the identity. And when you know the extension theorem of Müller-Vasilescu or of Arveson, then you know, you pretty much know to guess that the extremals will have to be of the type S star plus U, where S is a D shift of some multiplicity and U is a spherical unitary. So spherical unitary I have explained. D shift is the multiplication tuple by the coordinate functions on I call it the Drury Arveson Hardy space. It's been called various names here before. Everybody used the notation H2D or H2N, and so you start wondering what the H stands for in that, if you call it Fock space or Drury Arveson space. So. But it's the space of analytic functions in the ball that's defined by the reproducing kernel. As I've written down there, that sort of looks like the Hardy kernel in one variable. Okay, so that's what the D shift is, and so the extremals are supposed to be these operators. And I have Carl Sundberg and I tried to understand this theorem in terms of Agler's theorem. So we tried to give a proof of this in the spirit that you want to use Jim's theorem to prove it. So you have to prove you have to characterize the extremals somehow using spatial properties rather than using some bigger maps on C-star algebras and things like that. So what we came up with then is what we noticed was that what we have here, this S star plus U, is obviously the analog of the one variable situation. It looks like the Wolf decomposition of an isometry or co-isometry already, except that we didn't really have a definition of what an analog of the co-isometry is. And so so that's what we came up with here, is that we sort of came up with a spatial definition of what's the analog of, you know, if you apply it to the adjoint, would be what's the analog of an isometry, commuting isometry in one variable. And the conditions are that, three conditions, that the summation Ti star Ti is a projection. So notice here, this is because I'm looking at spherical isometries. People have been looking at row contractions. I'm looking at spherical contractions in this case. There's a sort of, the stars sort of end up at different sides. I have a T star, a S star here while I'm looking at the T. So the Ti star Ti is a projection. Then the second condition is that the Kozul complex is exact at the first stage, at the stage lambda 1. And then I have this third condition there, that the summation Ti, Ti star is greater than the identity. Now, I do want to give you a few ideas about what's going on and why you come up with these three conditions. But let's first have a look at the situation D equals 1, how these three conditions here reduce to the familiar ones for co-isometry. So of course the first condition that I had up there is in one variable, it's just that T star T is a projection. So that's just saying that T is a partial isometry. The condition, the second one, was the exactness of the Kozul complex. That then just says that T is onto. So if you have a partial isometry that's onto, then T star is already an isometry. So the first two conditions already imply that you have an isometry. Then what do we need the third condition for? The third condition just reduces to then T star is greater than the identity. So that again says that T is onto. So in one variable, condition 1 and 3 implies that you have a co-isometry in conditions 1 and 2. Also, in several variables, it's easy to come up with examples that show that neither condition 1 and 2 or condition 1 and 3 alone will give you what you want. So again, the example is the first example is the Hardy shift. In that case, we have T, the multiplication by Z on the Hardy space. Of course, it's not extremal because you can extend it to L2 on the Hardy space. So it can't, if my theorem is true, it can't satisfy all three conditions. And you do know about the Kozul complex. So you do know the exactness of the Kozul complex at the second stage for the Hardy shift. And of course, when you look at the first condition, that the summation of Ti star Ti is equal to a projection, in this case, you get that that's the identity. So the first two conditions are satisfied, but the third one is not satisfied because you have a kernel for the adjoints. They're the constants on the kernel of the adjoints. The example that 1 and 3 are satisfied, but 2 is not satisfied is, you know, it's the second favorite example of everybody. You take the invariant subspace in H2D of all functions that vanish at the origin, and then you compress the adjoint of the D shift to that invariant subspace, and it's easy enough to check that that satisfies 1 and 3, but not 2. Okay, so having said that, I was going to say a few words about the proof. So let's note the following, that when you try to prove A implies B, that you know, when you try to prove B implies A, then that comes for free when you prove the other direction first, or almost. So let's say you have to, first you have to prove that spherical unitaries are extremal. That's not very difficult. I mean, in fact, when I talked about the previous theorem with the spherical isometries and Atavalis theorem, you've done all the work that you needed to do to prove that spherical unitaries are extremal. Okay, well, let's suppose we've already proven that A implies B. And then we want to prove that B implies A. Well, let's start out with a zero operator acting, the tuple of zero operators acting on some Hilbert space. Well, by Agler's theorem, we know it extends to some extremal. Well, the extremal, when we prove that A implies B, we know that all extremals are of this type S star plus U. maybe not all of them are extremals, but if it's an extremal, it has to look somehow like that. Well, because I started out with a zero operator, there had to be some S star there, because if the S star was absent, and if I just take the U restricted to an invariant subspace, I get a spherical isomery. So anytime you start out with something that's not a spherical isomery, in the extension, you have to have some S star. Okay, well then, once you have an extremal, and you have an extremal as a direct sum of two things, it's easy to check that every summand has to be an extremal. It just follows immediately from the definition. And so once you have an extremal of the type S star plus U, then it easily follows that S star is an extremal. So that's how it follows that the D shift, the adjoint of the D shift is extremal. It comes for free, basically. In fact, when you want to have a dilation theorem or extension theorem, you have to have something like the S star there. It's pretty clear anyway. Okay, so that part is pretty obvious, provided you've proved all the other ones. So then let's see. So that would be B implies A. So A implies C. Well, I don't have all the details written out, but let's say we are starting out with an extremal. And let's suppose we start out with the first condition, and suppose that's not satisfied, so that Ti star Ti, the summation of that, is not a projection. Well, that's a self-adjoint operator whose spectral measure lives on the interval 0, 1. And if it's not a projection, that means there's some vector that's supported strictly between 0 and 1. And you can use that to make yourself a rank 1 extension, a non-trivial rank 1 extension for your operator tuple T. So in that case, then you get a non-trivial rank 1 extension, so that can't be extremal. All right, so the next case then is, now we'll be assuming that the first one is true, that this is a projection, but we're saying that the second one is not satisfied, the Kozul complex is not exact. And then, again, the Kozul complex not being exact means the range of some mapping is not equal to the kernel of some other mapping in the complex, and the first condition being a projection means that the range of the first map would have to be closed, so there's something orthogonal to the range of that in the kernel of the other map, and there's a vector given to you right there, and you use that and you make yourself a rank 1 extension, non-trivial rank 1 extension. So again, that works out rather nicely. And so then I'm in the situation where I can assume the first two and have to assume maybe the third one's not satisfied. But for that situation, we've proven the theorem that if any time you have an operator that satisfies operator tuple that satisfies the first two conditions, namely that the summation Ti star Ti is a projection and that the Kozul complex is exact at the stage lambda 1, then it has to be of the type S star plus V, where V is a spherical isometry. So, I mean, that was really the thing we were looking for. When you have an operator of this type, S star plus V, and you look at these summation Ti star Ti, that has to be a projection, of course, but also when you iterate that, so when you look at summation Ti star, Ti, Tj, that has to be a projection also. And so, and when you iterate that, it's always a projection. And so at first we were thinking perhaps that would have to be in the theorem here, but it turns out that this condition on the Kozul complex gives you automatically that all those other ones are projections also. So you just have that simple one condition there. Okay, and then once you have that theorem, it is actually pretty easy to also to show the rest of what was still lacking here, that if you have C, that implies B. It's pretty clear because you're almost there. You just have to use Atavalli's theorem to deal with the possibility of the spherical isometry being there instead of the U. But that's really the only case where it's possible that we need an infinite extension, where we can't get by with the rank 1 extensions. Okay, so now I want to talk about another family, the commuting row contractions. So these are the adjoints of the spherical contractions. They form a family because we can, when we write them as row contractions, they satisfy that summation Ti Xi has norm squared less than or equal to the norm of Xi squared. So if you restrict to an invariant subspace from this statement here, you can see that restrictions to an invariant subspace satisfy this. we have the this condition here, the second one, which is equivalent, gives you that it satisfies the C-star algebra condition, so these row contractions form families also. And of course, since they're adjoint tuples of the spherical contractions that I just considered, of course, we have a dilation theorem for these row contractions. And that means they're all compressions to co-invariant subspaces for S plus U star, where S is a D-shift and U is a spherical unitary. But it doesn't answer the question immediately, at least, what are the extremals of the row contractions, or is that an interesting family to consider? Okay, so there I'm a little bit of, and I have a little bit of an explanation gap here, because that is a question that I can perhaps answer when I know the answer what the extremals are. For, you know, the theorem, it looks like, you know, we already have the good theorem there. We have the dilation theorem of the type S star plus U. What better could happen? Well, if you think that way, then that theorem should tell you, should help you to prove the theorem about what the extremals are here. And so my standpoint is that if you are interested in row contractions or spherical contractions, then you have to be interested in all kinds of elementary questions about them, and you have to try to find an answer, even if the eventual answers don't have a place in your final theory. Okay, so, and I don't know what the answer is here, so I have just some partial results that I want to share with you. Here I've written out that elementary lemma on how you get non-trivial rank one extensions. So I've I've written up on the board here. What you want to do is you want to consider a non-trivial rank one extension of your operator tuple Ti, and to make it commuting, you have to have this condition two. You want to make it non-trivial, so at least one of the xi's has to be non-zero. That's the first condition, and then you want to choose the epsilon small that decreases the norm or somehow makes this hopefully a row contraction if you can guarantee that all the xi's are in the range of the d star. Okay, so if the d star, the defect operator, I've defined it up here, that has the adjoints on the right. So if the D star is zero, then you cannot do this with rank one extensions. And it's actually pretty easy to see that if the defect operator D star is zero, you have an extremal. I'll restate that in a moment. The remark I want to do here is that this sort of is a technical lemma that has worked out the trivial situation. It does have that problem that where it differs from the previous situations, that there are non-extremals with only trivial finite rank extensions. So this theorem will never answer the whole question. Thing that I hadn't mentioned, but I have written up there, that it's equivalent to have a non-trivial rank one extension or a non-trivial finite rank extension is pretty obvious, that because if you have an operator of finite rank sitting here, then it'll have some common eigenvalue. And so you want to restrict yourself to that eigenvector down here, and that would give you something up there. Well, that might be trivial in that point. So there might be, you might start out with something non-trivial where you have a finite rank operator here, something non-zero up here, but when you restrict to just that eigenvector, you might get a zero up here. Well, but then you can sort of cross out that row and column that goes with that and reduce your dimension by one and then play the same game again. So in any case, those two things are equivalent. So what's really lacking here is a method to find infinite rank, non-trivial infinite rank extensions for the row contractions. Okay, so the simple theorem, and really everything I have here is simple, I've already mentioned that if the defect operator D star is zero, then this has to be an extremal. So those are operators that you might call spherical co-isometries, because the adjoint tuples are spherical isometries. Or would they be co-spherical isometries? Don't know. Okay, so that's that. The previous theorem tells you that if the defect operator is very large, so if it's onto, then it cannot be extremal. So let's just do that, because here, if the defect operator d star is onto, then any xi will be in the range of d star. And so all you need to do is you need to take xi to be ti of some vector x. Okay, so if t is not the zero tuple, you find some vector x such that not all the xi's are going to be zero. If you take ti x, they'll be in the range of d star if d star is onto, and they will, I wanted to take ti minus bi x, and then it will satisfy this, or I could take just bi, all the b's to be zero, and take xi to be ti x. And then I have these three conditions satisfied, and see that way that this is not extremal. So if d star is onto, it's not extremal. So if the defect operator is large, it's not extremal. If the defect operator is a projection, then this condition that I had on the previous page at b equals zero, namely has to do with the Kozul complex. Again, you see that condition coming out there. But that actually characterizes the extremals. So if the d star is a projection, then the condition is that t is not an extremal Vogt contraction if and only if there exists this xi is in the range of d star, such that ti xj is tj xi. It's fairly easy to prove, and I'll skip the proof. The problem with this is that this condition, so first of all, it can't characterize all of the extremals, because I already mentioned there are extremals that don't have finite rank extensions, and this part C of the theorem in its proof, it shows that in this case you do have finite rank extensions. Also, it's not invariant under Taken-Ball automorphisms. If you look at that first condition, that d star is a projection, and you take a Ball automorphism of the T, then the corresponding defect operator for the phi lambda of T may not be a projection again. Okay, so that's, you might say, well, okay, so you write down a condition that makes that invariant under the Ball automorphisms, but now it just gets cumbersome and it still doesn't succeed in describing everything, so I spared the details here. In the other theorem that I had about the spherical contractions, something interesting happens. Here, I do have a similar condition, condition one, that says something is a projection, and if you apply a Ball automorphism to the T's, then the resulting thing is not going to be a projection. But it turns out that if you combine it with the other two conditions, it is true that if you take a D-shift and you take a Ball automorphism of a D-shift, you get another D-shift. It's unitarily equivalent to a D-shift. So these three conditions together imply the invariance under Ball automorphisms. Okay, so the only perhaps a little bit interesting result I have to say about extremals of commuting Vogt contractions is that if the defect operator has rank 1, so again, it's fairly small, the defect operator being large gives you not extremal, defect operator being 0, of course, is extremal, so if the defect operator is small, you'd expect a lot of extremals, perhaps. And so the condition here is that t is extremal if and only if, so you look at the span of u, t1u, up to tdu, where u is the vector that defines your rank 1 defect operator. If that dimension of that span is bigger than or equal to 3, then it has to be extremal. And the proof that something like that is extremal, again, is fairly easy. So let's look at this. So let's say we have an extension of a non-trivial extension of T. So it looks of the type Ti AI 0 BI. Then because it is a Vogt contraction, It is, like I had before, you know, these xi's had to be in the range of the defect operator d star. Similarly, you show that the range of the ai's have to be contained in the range of the d star if this is a row contraction. So that's fairly simple. And then you have the commutativity in the right upper entry that tells you that ti aj minus tj ai would have to be aj bi minus ai bj. I have reordered this, so normally you would say ti aj plus ai bj equals the same thing with I and j switched. So this is just that condition reordered. Now, if the defect operator has rank 1, then you see that on the right-hand side, so the AIs are contained, the range of AI is contained in the range of D star. So the AIs basically just have to be some multiple of U. And so on the right-hand side, you have a multiple of U here, no matter what the Bs are. And on the left-hand side, you have TJU times some multiple of TJU and some multiple of TIU. So if TIU, TJU, and U are linearly independent, then that means all the coefficients had to be 0. And so if we only have 3, say T1 and T2, then that would already show that the corresponding A's would have to be 0. And so that means that this had to be extremal. If you have more than that, that follows similarly. So if you have more than two operators, it goes the same way. And so that gives you one direction of this theorem. And the other direction, now you have, you again get by with rank 1 extensions, and you just write one down and observe that it works. Okay, well, that seems like a rather weak theorem. It does have applications, so if you look at the D-shift, and you take an invariant subspace for the D-shift, and you compress the D-shift to the author complement, then you get a row contraction. And in that case, the D star will have rank 1 if you take the D shift just acting on the dual Iverson space, the multiplicity 1. So it's just like in the one variable situation, defect operator has rank 1 in that case. And so you can restate the theorem that I had there by trying to figure out what that condition that this dimension is bigger than 3 means in terms of the invariant subspace that you started out with. And it's very simple to figure out. And so what we get is that if you start out with an invariant subspace of H2D, and you want to consider the row contraction of the compression to the author complement of M, then that compression is not extremal if and only if the space M contains a lot of linear polynomials. So this space L here is the D plus one dimensional subspace of linear polynomials. And if you have a lot of linear polynomials in M, then it's not extremal. In all other cases, it is extremal. So most invariant subspaces won't even contain any polynomials at all. And so in that case, you get extremals. So you get a lot of extremals here. So, you know, personally, I was a little disappointed because I was thinking I would get some interesting conditions, some interesting invariant subspaces that have some properties. But in this case, most things are extremal. And if you investigate a little bit further, the only time when it's non-extremal in this situation is that basically all the TIs that you get as PM perp S restricted to M perp are just linear functions of one fixed operator that can be extended. And in all other cases, basically the requirement that it's commutative prevents you from finding non-trivial extensions. Okay, and the last remark here is that, you know, you can make some interesting examples of extremals on finite dimensional spaces. That is because I wrote that down and I found that somewhat interesting because a lot of times when you consider extremals, all you get are just the unitary matrices on finite dimensional spaces. So in this case, you get some other extremals. All right, so then let me close with remarks about the situation I know less about is the non-commutative situation. So in that case, you can of course also do this program of identifying the extremals, and in that case, it's very easy because you don't have to worry about when you construct something, you don't have to worry about commutativity. And in each case, you get by with non-trivial rank one extensions. So this infinite rank extension that seems to be a necessity for the commuting row contractions doesn't show up in the non-commutative case either. So, all right, thank you.